Craig installed himself at Jock's desk and consulted the cryptic notes that he had made from Henry Pickering's file. His first call was to the American Embassy in Harare, the capital 300 miles northeast of Bulawayo. "Mr. Morgan Oxford, your cultural attaché, please," he asked the operator. "Oxford." The accent was crisp Boston and Ivy League. "Craig Miller. A mutual friend asked me to call you and give you his regards." "Oh, yes, I was expecting you. Won't you come in here any time and say hello?" "I'd enjoy that," Craig told him, and hung up. Henry Pickering was as good as his word. Any message handed to Oxford would go out in the diplomatic bag and be on Pickering's desk within 12 hours. His next call was to the office of the Minister of Tourism and Information, and he finally got through to the Minister's secretary. Her attitude changed to warm cooperation when he spoke to her in Sindabeli. "The Comrade Minister is in Harare for the sitting of Parliament," she told him, and gave Craig his private number at the house. Craig got through to a parliamentary secretary on his fourth attempt. The telephone system had slowly begun deteriorating, he noticed. The blight of all developing countries was lack of skilled artisans. Prior to independence, all linesmen had been white, and since then most of them had taken the gap. This secretary was Mashona, and insisted on speaking English, as proof of her sophistication. "Kindly state the nature of the business to be discussed." She was obviously reading from a printed form. "Personal. I am acquainted with the Comrade Minister."
"Ah, yes. P-E-R-S-O-N-N-E-L,
the secretary spelled it out laboriously as she wrote it. "No, that's P-E-R-S-O-N-A-L, only one N," Craig corrected her patiently. He was beginning to adjust to the pace of Africa again.
"I will consult the Comrade Minister's schedule. You will be obliged to telephone again."
Craig consulted his list. Next was the Government Registrar of Companies, and this time he was lucky. He was put through to an efficient and helpful clerk who made a note of his requirements.
"The share register, articles and memorandum of association of the company trading as Rowlands Limited, formerly known as Rhodesian Lands and Mining Limited."
He heard the disapproval in the clerk's tone of voice. Rhodesian was a dirty word nowadays, and Craig made a mental resolution to change the company's name, if ever he had the power to do so. Zimlands would sound a lot better to an African ear.
"I will have Roniot copies ready for you to collect by 4 o'clock,
the clerk assured him.
"The search fee will be $15.
Craig's next call was to the Surveyor General's office, and again he arranged for copies of documents, this time the titles to the company properties, the ranches, King's Lynn, Queen's Lynn, and the Chizarrera estates. Then there were 14 other names on his list, all of whom had been ranching in Matabele land when he left, close neighbours and friends of his family, those that Grandpa Bawu had trusted and liked. Of the 14 he could contact only 4. The others had all sold up and taken the long road southwards. The remaining families sounded genuinely pleased to hear from him. "Welcome back, Craig. We've all read the book and watched it on TV." But they clammed up immediately he started asking questions. "Damn telephone leaks like a sieve," said one of them. "Come out to the ranch for dinner, stay the night. Always a bed for you, Craig. Lord knows there aren't so many of the old faces around anymore." Jock Daniels returned in the middle of the afternoon, red-faced and sweating.
"Still burning up my telephone," he growled. "Wonder if the bottle store has another bottle of that Dimplehag."
Craig responded to this subtlety by crossing the road and bringing back the pinch bottle in a brown paper bag.
"I forgot that you have to have a cast-iron liver to live in this country."
He unscrewed the cap and dropped it into the waste-paper basket. At 5:10, he telephoned the minister's parliamentary office again.
"The Comrade Minister Tungata Zebiwe has graciously consented to meet you at 10:00 on Friday morning. He can allow you 20 minutes.
Please convey my sincere thanks to the minister." That gave Craig 3 days to kill, and meant he would have to drive the 300 miles to Harare.
"No reply from Zurich?"
He sweetened Jock's glass.
If you made me an offer like that, I wouldn't bother to answer either, Jock grumped, as he took the bottle from Craig's hand and added a little more to the glass. Over the next few days, Craig availed himself of the invitations to visit Bawu's old friends, and was smothered with traditional old Rhodesian hospitality. Of course you can't get all the luxuries, Cross and Blackwell jams, or Bronley soap anymore, one of his hostesses explained, as she piled his plate with rich fare. But somehow, it's fun making do. And she signalled the white-robed table servant to refill the silver dish with baked sweet potatoes. He spent the days with darkly tanned, slow-speaking men in wide-brimmed felt hats and short khaki trousers, examining their sleek fat cattle from the passenger seat of an open Land Rover. "You still can't beat Matabeleland beef," they told him proudly. "Sweetest grass in the whole world. Of course, we have to send it all out through South Africa, but the prices are damn good. Glad I didn't run for it. Heard from old Derek Sanders in New Zealand, working as a hired hand on a sheep station now, and a bloody tough life too. No Matabele to do the dirty work over there." He looked at his black herders with paternal affection. "They're just the same, under all the political claptrap. Salt of the bloody earth, my boy. My people, I feel that they are all family. I'm glad I didn't desert them." "Of course there are problems," another of his hosts told him. "Foreign exchange is murder. Difficult to get tractor spares and medicine for the stock. But Mugabe's government is starting to wake up. As food producers, we are getting priority on import permits for essentials and things like that. Of course, the telephones only work when they do, and the trains don't run on time any longer. There's rampant inflation, but the beef prices keep in step with it. They have opened the schools, but we send the kids down south across the border, so they get a decent education." "And the politics?" "Well, that's between black and black, Matabele and Mashona. Well, the white man's out of it now, thank God. Let the bastards tear each other to pieces if they want to. I keep my nose clean, and it's not a bad life. Not like the old days, of course, but then it never is it? Would you buy more land?" "Haven't got the money, old boy. But if you did have..." The rancher rubbed his nose thoughtfully. "Perhaps a man could make an absolute mint one day, if the country comes right, land prices what they are at the moment. Or he could lose the lot if it goes the other way. You could say the same of the stock exchange. But in the meantime, it's a good life?" "It's a good life. And hell, I was weaned on Zambezi waters. I don't reckon I'd be happy breathing London smog or swatting flies in the Australian outback." On Thursday morning, Craig drove back to the motel, picked up his laundry, repacked his single canvas holdall, paid his bill, and checked out. He called at Jock's office. "Still no news from Zurich?" "Telex came in an hour ago."
Jock handed him the flimsy, and Craig scanned it swiftly. "We'll grant your client 30-day option to purchase all Roland's company paid-up shares for $500,000 US payable Zurich in full on signature. No further offers countenanced." They did not come more final than that. Bawu had said double your estimate, and so far he had been right. Jock was watching his face.
"Double your original offer," he pointed out. "Can you swing $500,000?
"I'll have to talk to my rich uncle," Craig teased him. "And anyway, I've got 30 days. I'll be back before then."
"Well, where can I reach you?" Jock asked.
"Don't call me, I'll call you." He begged another tankful from Jock's private stock and took the Volkswagen out on the road to the northeast, towards Mashonaland and Harare, and ran into the first roadblock 10 miles out of town. "Almost like the old days," he thought, as he climbed down onto the verge. Two black troopers in camouflage battle smocks searched the Volkswagen for weapons with painstaking deliberation, while a lieutenant with the cap badge of the Korean-trained 3rd Brigade examined his passport. Once again, Craig rejoiced in the family tradition, whereby all the expectant mothers in his family, on both the Mello and Ballantyne side, had been sent home to England for the event. That little blue booklet, with the gold lion and unicorn, and Oni Soit Qui Mal y Pense printed on the cover, still demanded a certain deference, even at a 3rd Brigade roadblock. It was late afternoon when he crested the line of low hills and looked down on the little huddle of skyscrapers that rose so incongruously out of the African felt, like headstones to the belief in the immortality of the British Empire. The city that had once borne the name of Lord Salisbury, the foreign secretary who had negotiated the Royal Charter of the British South Africa Company, had reverted to the name Harare, after the original Shona chieftain whose cluster of mud and thatch huts the white pioneers had found on the site in September 1890, when they finally completed the long trek up from the south. The streets also had changed their names, from those commemorating the white pioneers and Victoria's empire, to those of the sons of the Black Revolution and its allies. "A street by any other name," Craig resigned himself. Once he entered the city, he found there was a boomtown atmosphere. The pavements thronged with noisy black crowds, and the foyer of the modern 16-storied Monomotapa Hotel resounding to 20 different languages and accents, as tourists jostled visiting bankers and businessmen, foreign dignitaries, civil servants and military advisers. There was no vacancy for Craig until he spoke to an assistant manager who had seen the TV production and read the book. Then Craig was ushered up to a room on the 15th floor, with a view over the park. While he was in his bath, a procession of waiters arrived bearing flowers and baskets of fruit and a complimentary bottle of South African champagne. He worked until after midnight on his report to Henry Pickering and was at the Parliament Buildings in Causeway by 9:30 the next morning. The minister's secretary kept him waiting for 45 minutes before leading him through into the panelled office beyond, and Comrade Minister Tungata Zebiwa stood up from his desk. Craig had forgotten how powerful was this man's presence. Or perhaps he had grown in stature since their last meeting. When he remembered that once Tungata had been his servant, his gun boy, when Craig was a ranger in the Department of Game Conservation, it seemed that it had been a different existence. In those days he had been Samson Kumalo, for Kumalo was the royal bloodline of the Matabele kings, and he was their direct descendant. Butso, his great-grandfather, had been the leader of the Matabele Rebellion of 1896, and had been hanged by the settlers for his part in it. His great-great-grandfather, Gundang, had been half-brother to Lobengula, the last king of the Matabele, whom Rhodes' troopers had ridden to an ignoble death, an unmarked grave in the northern wilderness, after destroying his capital at Gubulawayo, the place of killing. Royal was his bloodlines, and kingly still his bearing. Taller than Craig, well over 6 foot, and lean, not yet running to flesh, which was often the Matabele trait, his physique was set off to perfection by the cut of his Italian silk suit, shoulders wide as a gallows tree, and a flat greyhound's belly. He had been one of the most successful bushfighters during the war, and he was a warrior still. Of that there was no doubt. Craig experienced a powerful and totally unexpected pleasure at seeing him once more. "I see you, Comrade Minister," Craig greeted him, speaking in Sindibele, avoiding having to choose between the old familiar Sam and the nom de guerre that he now used, Tungata Zabiwe, which meant the seeker after justice. "I sent you away once," Tungata answered in the same language. "I discharged all debts between us and sent you away." There was no return light of pleasure in his smoky dark eyes. The heavily boned jaw was set hard. "I'm grateful for what you did," Craig was unsmiling also, covering his pleasure. It was Tungata who had signed a special ministerial order allowing Craig to export his self-built yacht Bawu from the territory in the face of the rigid exchange control laws which forbade the removal of even a refrigerator or an iron bedstead. At that time, the yacht had been Craig's only possession, and he had still been crippled by the mine blast and confined to a wheelchair. "I do not want your gratitude," said Tungata. Yet there was something behind the burnt honey-coloured eyes that Craig could not fathom. "Nor the friendship I still offer you?" Craig asked gently. "All that died on the battlefield," Tungata said. "It was washed away in blood. You chose to go. Now why have you returned?"
because this is my land.
Your land? He saw the reddish glaze of anger suffuse the whites of Tungata's eyes. Your land? You speak like a white settler, like one of Cecil Rhodes's murdering troopers.
I did not mean it that way.
Your people took the land at Rifle Point, and at the point of a rifle they surrendered it. Do not speak to me of your land.
You hate almost as well as you fought, Craig told him, feeling his own anger begin to prickle at the back of his eyes. But I did not come back to hate. I came back because my heart drew me back. I came back because I felt I could help to rebuild what was destroyed.
Tungata sat down behind his desk and placed his hands upon the white blotter. They were very dark and powerful. He stared at them in a silence that stretched out for many seconds.
You were at King's Lynn, Tungata broke the silence at last, and Craig started. Then you went north to the Chizarira.
Your eyes are bright, Craig nodded. They see all.
You have asked for copies of the titles to those lands.
Again Craig was startled, but he remained silent.
But even you must know that you must have government approval to purchase land in Zimbabwe. You must state the use to which you intend to put that land, and the capital available to whack it.
Yes, even I know that, Craig agreed.